Madagascar is just like that. 80 or 90% of all its plants and animals are unique. The species are unique to Madagascar. You go there and you look and you say, oh, that's a nuthatch. Uh-uh, it's a coral-billed vanga. It's a bird that whose whole family only lives on Madagascar.
New species of wildlife are being found on the island of Madagascar. But even as they are found, many are doomed to extinction. This week on the Nature Stories podcast, researchers focus their efforts on the future of this extraordinary place. I'm Samantha Brown with Atlantic Public Media, curating this podcast in collaboration with the Nature Conservancy and the Public Radio Exchange. Each week we bring you pieces about the intersection of people and place. Up now, Noah's Raft, Saving Madagascar's Wildlife Without the Ark, produced in 2005 by Laura Dernford and Daniel Grossman with Radio Netherlands.
The forest doesn't really wake up till sunset. Then frogs call for mates, owls hoot, leaves rustle softly as something in the dark eats a fruit or stalks its prey. Primeval rainforests occupy only about 2% of Earth's land, yet contain around half of all terrestrial species. They're being cut today at a furious rate. Every 5 seconds, 1 hectare, or about 2.4 acres of tropical forest is cleared for grazing, agriculture, and other purposes. Every month, an area of rainforest about the size of Belgium is cleared somewhere. It's easy to imagine the major villains as short-sighted ranchers, corrupt politicians, and unscrupulous timber companies. But in Madagascar, most enemies of the forest are of a different breed. In a country where a third of the people are undernourished, the forest's foes are the poorest of the poor. Sometimes on the verge of starvation, they're just scraping by. Primate researcher Allison Jolly writes about one such man in her book, A World Like Our Own, Man and Nature in Madagascar. She found him carrying his indispensable coop-coop axe.
With a coop-coop over his shoulder and a brindled dog behind him, Jean Darmon strode up the mountain path, as though he wore Paul Bunyan's boots instead of cracked calluses upon his heels. Jean is the rainforest's executioner. He's the last frontiersman in a world that has no wilderness to spare. In defiance of Malgache law and all principles of conservation, he still tackles the virgin forest with his coop-coop. He brings down rosewood, towering white rami trees, and Hintzi, the cabinet maker's prize with its crimson heart. These rainforest hardwoods are too dense even to float, and must rot for 1 or 2 years before Jean can burn their trunks to enlarge his little homestead clearing.
These trees release so much water vapor through their leaves, they alter the weather. In their great green canopies live whole communities of plants and animals, including voluptuous orchids, blankets of moss, vines, and tree-dwelling rodents. For the forest, such trees are the cornerstone of life. To a forest executioner with a family to feed, they're a stack of valuable lumber. A single hole in the canopy severs threads in the living fabric of the forest and takes years to heal. As more trees are cut, the fabric unravels irreversibly. That's what's happening to Madagascar's virgin or primary forest. Only about 10% of it remains intact. Biologists and conservationists around the world are watching Madagascar's forests anxiously, concerned about the fate of its distinctive wildlife. Allison Jolly says Madagascar's forests may look like any other at first glance, but up close, they're very different.
Madagascar is a kind of science fiction world. You know, every science fiction writer tries the tale of alternate worlds. You know, what would happen if time broke its banks and came to the present down a different channel? Well, Madagascar is just like that. 80 or 90% of all its plants and animals are unique. The species are unique to Madagascar. You go there and you look and you say, oh, that's a nuthatch. Uh-uh, it's a coral-billed vanga. It's an animal, a bird that whose whole family only lives on Madagascar. You look and you say, oh, that's Arizona. That's a cactus. Oops. No, it isn't quite right. It's 20 foot tall and it sticks up like a giant hand against the sky and it's got thorns all down it, but it's got wood inside. It isn't a cactus.
Perhaps the most famous of Madagascar's animals is a primitive group of primates called lemurs. Dr. Jolly, who's a lemur expert, says they don't even look like anything elsewhere.
You look at lemurs and you think, wait a minute, that's not a cat, and that's not a squirrel, and it's got hands with fingernails and big round eyes that look right at you, so what is it? And they live in societies that are like ours, but with real twists, like complete female dominance.
Madagascar is special, not just because most of what lives there lives only there. It's also because of the bewildering variety of what's there. Take plants. There are 12 to 16,000 species of plants native to Madagascar.
By comparison, all of North America, north of Mexico, has about 18,000.
Primate expert Russell Mittermeier is president of Conservation International, one of the world's leading non-governmental advocates for tropical forest protection. He says the island is unusually rich in many other animals, too, including snakes and chameleons among the reptiles.
The estimates run from about 340 to as many as 380 species of reptiles in this island that is a little bit larger than California and a little smaller than Texas. In all of the United States north of Mexico, you've got about 300 reptile species. It looks like we're going to go up to as high as 300 amphibian species in Madagascar. This is more than all of the United States and Canada put together.
But Madagascar's phenomenal fauna is not what it used to be.
Okay, try a little brush. Where'd the brush go?
Biologist David Burney squats on the balls of his feet on the floor of a pit the size and shape of a grave.
Whoa. So is that just hippo? I mean, it's not tortoise.
Hands caked in mud, face bronzed by the relentless sun, Burney breaks the compacted soil with the smack of a geologist's pointed hammer.
The largest hole that I've dug like this, with occasionally use of a small pick, but mostly just with my bare hands so I don't break up stuff and scratch it, is about 60 feet long and 20 feet wide and 20 feet deep. I think we've probably in that one site done this kind of stuff, sifting all of it bit by bit, picking everything off, to now a total of about 200 cubic meters. So, you know, I must like doing this. I don't know. I don't seem to mind it anyway.
For more than two decades, Burney has been researching what Madagascar was like before it was peopled. He believes learning the fate of wildlife in the past will help to anticipate, or perhaps to shape, the fortunes of wildlife in the future. Madagascar's original settlers, probably Indonesian people sailing outrigger canoes, arrived here about 2,000 years ago. Burney says they must have been astounded by the wildlife they discovered, including the largest bird that ever lived, the elephant bird.
Elephant birds were probably up to about 1,000 pounds, 500 kilos, and stood 10 feet tall, over 3 meters. Try to imagine an ostrich multiplied by 3 or 4.
This colossal flightless fowl was among dozens of oversized creatures known as megafauna, unique to Madagascar. The remarkable menagerie included a gorilla-sized lemur, a coffee table-sized tortoise, and a cow-sized hippopotamus-like creature.
So we had a really diverse landscape here, a lot of different kinds of mammals, a lot of diversity of primates, not like any place else on Earth, and now it seems to all be gone.
Today, these bizarre giants are extinct. Aside from the crocodile, the largest native animal now is not much bigger than an overfed pussycat. Burney says humans almost certainly starred in this murder mystery, though the murder weapon and the exact scene of the crime are unknown. Was it hunting in marshes, logging in forests, burning in savannas? Whatever it was that humans did to the megafauna, the scientist says his gut tells him the purge is not over yet.
My suspicion is that Madagascar is still in an extinction event. It's simply affecting now smaller animals and perhaps eventually even some plants.
Bernie believes the biggest breeds went first because large animals are generally more affected by forest clearing, hunting, and the like than small ones. They need more territory, and they generally breed and thus recover from disturbance more slowly. Hunters find them easier to spot and more worthwhile to catch. Today, Madagascar's once continuous forest canopy has turned into an archipelago of tiny embattled wildlife strongholds in a sea of farmland and pastures. Now even the smallest creatures are at risk.
What we see today is the last remaining sliver of the vast primary forest that used to cover Madagascar.
Agricultural expert Mark Freudenberger says Madagascar's rural poor are trapped in an ill-fated cycle of forest destruction. In much of this country, the only new land available for farming is primary forest. So when farmland becomes exhausted and unproductive, and when new families need new plots, people are forced to clear virgin forest tracts. Bigger trees are sold as lumber and firewood. The rest is simply burned. The soils are thin and poor, but the canopies are nutrient-rich. Converted to ash, the burned vegetation makes land highly productive, at first. In a matter of years, the nutrients are expended and these plots become useless. The farmer's dream turns into a conservationist's nightmare as hungry families cut fresh parcels of virgin trees.
The processes of slash and burn or shifting cultivation are creating a conversion of natural forests into barren wastelands.
Mark Freudenberger runs a project to find less destructive practices with funds from USAID, the U.S. Agency for International Development. Madagascar is losing rainforest at between 1.5% and 5% a year. That's several times higher than the global average. At these rates, half of Madagascar's remaining forests could be gone in the time it takes to raise a child, and the island's native fauna will have almost nowhere to live. In a place where evolution's engines seem to have been turbocharged, even a tiny forest parcel sometimes contains distinct species found nowhere else in Madagascar, much less anywhere else on Earth. In the late 1980s, biologist Steve Goodman, a legendary bird and mammal expert, discovered firsthand how clearing a single forest tract can doom an entire species.
We surveyed a very interesting forest that I don't think anyone had ever been to before us.
The survey team had several wildlife specialists, including a herpetologist to study reptiles and amphibians.
And the herpetologist on that trip captured at least two animals that were new to science.
That's two reptiles that had never even been heard of before. A couple of years after the discoveries, Goodman returned to the site to snap some photographs to illustrate some of several papers about the new species.
And we went back to the place, and the forest had disappeared. And these papers were associated with the description of species new to science, but probably it was a description of extinct organisms. You know, in the course of 3 years, an important block of forest that had unique organisms disappeared.
What happened to it?
It was cut for slash and burn agriculture.
About 3% of Madagascar's remaining primary forest is under protection in parks. The country's president has pledged to triple that number by 2009. Achieving this goal will be tough, experts say. But even if it is accomplished, most of the country's forests will remain at risk. Like a modern Noah with only a raft instead of an ark, conservation officials must make agonizing decisions about which forest to save. Malagasy herpetologist Ashil Rasil Manana is helping out by collecting the information they need. Herpetologist Ashil, who like many Malagasy, usually goes only by his first name, has dug a long line of holes in the soil of a rainforest. It took him 2 bone-rattling days by jeep and 4 hours on foot to get here, a remote wooded valley in northeastern Madagascar. The earth underfoot here is springy. The air has the sweet smell of freshly cut grass. Lemurs bark out calls from treetops. Ashil is one of 4 biologists, each with a different specialty, setting traps and making observations here. He says he's been interested in snakes and frogs since childhood.
When I was a kid, I caught grasshopper, and I used them to catch frog. And then I used this frog to catch a snake, and then try to push them to vomit the frog, and sometimes it's still alive. So even when I was a kid, I really loved animals.
Decades and a doctorate in biology later, the researcher now gets paid to catch the slimy and slithering.
What we would like to do is to do a biological inventory to record what kind of animal lived in this area and what is their distribution.
The Malagasy scientist shoves a plastic bucket into each hole flush with the ground. A waist-high fence of plastic nailed to wooden stakes will funnel snake-like skinks, insects, and rodents, and other small animals into the containers. Once inside, the animals will be kept from escaping by the bucket's slick sides. Biologist Steve Goodman, who organized this trip, has done about 200 such surveys with funds from the Washington, D.C.-based World Wildlife Fund. The expeditions usually take place during Madagascar's wet season. Goodman says the rain brings out the animals, though traveling to remote forests is troublesome. In 2004, for instance, a trip led by Goodman was in the field when a powerful storm struck. Getting to the survey site took 3 days. Getting out took 11.
We would come to what formerly was just a small creek, and there was this raging torrent where you couldn't imagine how you would ever get across it. And we would find someone with a canoe, and we'd attach a rope to the other side of the river, get to the other side, then walk to the next river. It was difficult to make a fire to eat, water up to the waist or mud up to the knees for kilometer after kilometer after kilometer.
After 2 weeks at his site in northeastern Madagascar, herpetologist Ashil has completed his work. The study area is no bigger than a large city park, yet the team found a wide variety of birds, bats, and small insect-eating mammals. They spotted 12 species of lemurs, including a hairy-eared dwarf lemur, a raccoon-like animal with tufts of black fur sprouting from its ears. It's considered one of the world's rarest mammals. Ashil himself found 28 species of amphibians and 33 species of reptiles, including 5 never before known to science, 3 frogs, a skink, and most exciting for him, a spiny green chameleon.
To find a chameleon like this is very exciting. That's very John. I always in the forest when I have time.
Under the harsh light of a kerosene lantern, a group of women sing of natural disasters like locusts and cholera. Hope lies, they sing, with God. Members of a farmers' cooperative, they're relaxing after a nutrition workshop in a mountainous region in southern Madagascar. In a room nearby, Claude Ranivoujan, whose wife ran the session, worries about a different sort of disaster, this one caused by people.
When I was young, from here in our house, we could hear the lemurs crying and making noises. Now it is very quiet. Before, the mountains were covered in forest, and because of that, there was an abundance of water. There were a lot of springs surrounding the town. There were hundreds of small springs. But now most of those springs are dried out.
Claude's hamlet, Manampatrana, is in the middle of what was once a 100-kilometer or 60-mile-wide band of Madagascar's luscious forests running the entire length of the island's east coast. Now, apart from the very tops of the mountains and patches here and there, nearly the whole region has been cleared for subsistence crops. In the past, many people here profited from cash crops, but one left a bitter taste in the mouths of growers such as Claude.
There was a time where coffee costed 26 ariary a kilo. People were able to sell coffee and buy sugar, salt, rice, and even sardines.
Villagers tended saplings for years before any of the fragrant beans were ready for market. When the trees were finally mature, the efforts initially paid off. Some farmers even replaced their thatch roofs with tin for the first time. Then the coffee market collapsed. A decade later, coffee prices are still depressed, and many of the tin roofs here are rusting. Despite recent signs of recovery, Claude says growing coffee is too risky for most people here.
Today it's one plot price, in 15 days it's another, a month later it's another, and because of this constant fluctuation in price, they're no longer secure, and so they constantly go to the forest to find quick money, because through the forest you could always get quick money to survive day by day.
Claude hopes to save the remaining forest by making cultivated plots more profitable and productive for longer. Wearing a brimless straw hat in the gathering heat of the day, the Malagasy farmer walks briskly up a precipitous footpath. He passes men and women tending plots as steeply sloped as a Swiss chalet's roof. Unlike rice paddies on the valley bottom, when these fields are planted with crops such as rice, they're at risk of losing their soil to erosion from tropical downpours.
So what we see here is my plot where I've planted pineapple and banana.
Claude stops and motions majestically to a small plot of waist-high plants. In contrast to hillside rice and other annual crops planted on most of this valley's slopes, perennial crops like these don't get pulled up every year.
It is better to plant fruit trees, because fruit trees, the fruit is above ground and can be harvested above ground. If you plant plants that are tubers and whose produce is under the ground, that creates holes underneath the soil, which water can easily seep into, and the soil becomes more vulnerable and can be washed away.
He says planted in rice, this plot soil will be washed away in a few years. Planted in bananas, pineapple, lychee nuts, and other perennial crops, it could keep on producing virtually forever. With the income from the harvest, he can buy the staples he would otherwise grow himself. By generating income year after year, the long-lived plants are like his retirement account. His small fruit orchard is a farming practice that conservationists aim to encourage. They say the current pattern of agriculture has been fostered by economic forces beyond the control of ordinary farmers who need help to reassert themselves.
What we're seeing today is the ecological impact of the incorporation of Madagascar into the international economy.
USAID expert Mark Freudenberger says with luck, the global trade in agricultural products could help farmers to preserve the forest rather than force them to clear it.
So what we're doing now in Madagascar is focusing much more on how to create market incentives for practicing sustainable agriculture. We're working on increasing prices. We're working on increasing transport infrastructures so that transport costs come down and hence are more of an incentive of getting agricultural produce to the markets.
Freudenberger says the outlook is uncertain. For instance, a train line critical for shipping farm products is in danger of shutting down. But he hopes the farmers of this region will be able to achieve financial security and forest preservation by producing more bananas and pineapples, as well as lychee nuts, citrus fruits, and other cash crops that conserve the soil. He says a diverse suite of such crops, like an investment portfolio containing different stocks, could help them overcome the vagaries of the market. He says Claude's orchard is attracting the interest of other farmers who are gradually beginning to plant fields of perennial fruits and nuts. Many conservation specialists are also promoting ecotourism as a relatively benign source of desperately needed cash for Madagascar. Visits by foreigners who pay park fees and spend money on lodging, food, and supplies in villages near reserves are on the rise. Madagascar has also recently become more open to outsiders offering assistance. Biologist Steve Goodman.
You know, it's the first time in decades where there's really hope that something is actually going to happen and things are going to move in the right direction, both for the people of Madagascar and the unique patrimony that this island guards.
On a pedestrian walkway in downtown Antananarivo, the Malagasy capital, two barefoot boys sing of Jesus for tips. Believers must not be tempted by material things, they chant, and he'll return. The boys may not know it, but ever since settlers arrived here, the primary source of material goods has been the forests. But now the well is almost dry. Like these chants of spiritual salvation, many biologists are warning that salvation of the forests will require a dramatic change of heart. Madagascar's primeval habitats must no longer be seen as a source of land and lumber, but as the ark for preserving one of evolution's most precious gems. Lemur expert Allison Jolly.
All wild species, and above all wild ecosystems, are treasures. We don't know what economic treasures they're going to be. We can guess. But they're human treasures. They're treasures of climate, of watershed, of wonder, of awe, of understanding. For understanding ourselves, our own history from the lemurs, for understanding how an ecosystem fits together. We have no idea how this will expand into some renaissance of understanding nature and understanding our place in the world. The best we can do is just keep it.
That was Noah's Raft, produced in 2005 by Laura Dernford and Daniel Grossman with Radio Netherlands. The Nature Conservancy provides support for this podcast, online at nature.org/stories, committed to protecting nature and preserving life. If you'd like to hear more pieces like this one, go to the Public Radio Exchange at prx.org. Send us your thoughts and feedback to podcast@tnc.org. From Woodsall, Massachusetts, I'm Samantha Brown. Join us next week for a brand new Nature Stories podcast.